This program includes two talks on the United Nations. The first explains why the UN system must be restructured if it is to meet the challenges of the 21st century. The second describes two proposals for doing this. These talks were given in Madison, Wisconsin at meetings of the Dane County Chapter of the United Nations Association, USA, in June 2006 and June 2007. The first speaker is Charles Weitz. Mr. Weitz served the UN for many years, in UNESCO and in the Food and Agriculture Organization. His talk is entitled, The United Nations System, What Was Created in 1945 and What Has Developed Since Then. Charles Weitz.
I would like to start by making sure that you all are reminded of something that the late great Secretary General of the United Nations said, namely that we have to stop thinking about the United Nations as a drawing by Picasso, but that it is something that we have created ourselves. And that is true of the United Nations system, as we call it. Something in the neighborhood of 85% of the monies which governments either give it through the budget or voluntarily to the United Nations system go for economic and social activities, not political activities, not counting the cost of actual peacekeeping. The basic fundamentals of the system are economic and social. That is what the World Health Organization, the UNESCO, the Food and Agriculture Organization, the International Telecommunications Union, the Universal Postal Union, that's what they're all about. And that is where the bulk of the government monies go. What is the UN system? What is it that was created in 1945? And what has developed since then? When the governments wrote the charter and then started setting up the specialized agencies of the United Nations, they decided that the technical work of the United Nations should remain separate from the political. That in case the United Nations had the same fate as the League of Nations and collapsed, they didn't want the technical work to stop. And so the specialized agencies were created entirely independently of the United Nations, totally independently. They have their own member states. They have their own constitutions, which have to be accepted by governments. They have their own budgets. They elect their own leaders. They are in no way beholden to the Secretary General. They are in no way responsible to the General Assembly, and indeed, because of their fierce independence and because of the fact that they represent at the intergovernmental level the interests of the health ministries, the agriculture ministries, the trade ministries, and so on and so forth, they have quite a different approach to many problems than the foreign ministries will have when they meet at the United Nations. In fact, it is not at all uncommon, and those of us that have worked in the system for all of our lives are quite aware of the fact that governments very often do not speak with the same voice, that what they say in the governing council of one organization is not what they say in the governing council of another organization. The heads of the specialized agencies have no status at the United Nations. They're not allowed to address the General Assembly. And this, if I may say so, is not only a political and tactical error, but it is also one that breeds enormous competition and resentment. Well, having created this series of independent empires, these turfdoms, these groups that fight very much for their hour in the sun. How are they financed? Well, they're financed through the budget, just as the UN is. The contribution schedule is set by the United Nations, and each of the specialized agencies uses the same scale of contributions. The money that goes into the basic budgets of the agencies is for the fundamental structure. You know, it's for a personnel department and an accounting department and for running the conference for the Commission on Forestry or the Commission on Fisheries and so forth. But to take action, to do anything, governments have never permitted, except for a very small amount of money for the World Health Organization, have never permitted monies to go into the budgets of the agencies for action. In order to take action, they have to turn to the voluntary funds, to the United Nations Development Program, to UNICEF, to the World Food Program, to the various funds which have been set up by governments, which are voluntarily subscribed to, which governments can give money to or not give money to, depending upon their mood, depending upon what they think about that particular organization, that particular work, and what the economic conditions are. So, if I may say so, this is one hell of a way to run a railroad. You are trying to maintain a system of assistance from all of these specialized agencies to all of the third world and other countries of the world, and you depend upon voluntary contributions on which there is no assurance year to year as to the level, no assurance as to which funds will be renewed and under what conditions. It is not a way that is to give confidence either to the people administering it or to the people who are at the receiving end. There's then another question which we need to look at for just a minute, which is the leadership of the UN system. Let's take the Secretary General question first. I don't know where it is written in on what tablets of stone that the Secretary General cannot be from one of the developed countries. Where is this written down? Where does this come from? Who is it that made this decision, and why did they make it? You know, who's unemployed these days? Wouldn't Bill Clinton be a first-class Secretary General of the United Nations? But according to this unwritten law, he cannot be, because no one from a developed, from one of the big countries, can be elected Secretary General. Where is it written in tablets of stone that the Secretary Generalship has to rotate by region? Where did this come from? Why does it have to rotate by region? What difference does it make? What you are theoretically looking for is the person that is the best person to be Secretary General of the United Nations, not whether he is Asian or African or Latin American. These things are absolutely incredible. One other footnote I should put on that Secretary General thing, and that is that the Big Five have co-opted the veto power against the nomination for the Secretary General. Again, it is not in the Charter. It is not written any place that I know. And the veto power was for peace and security issues and was never intended to be for administrative matters. A most important piece of the architecture, which I would like to bring in now because it also relates to the heads of the agencies, and that is the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, which are not, bless your souls, not part of the United Nations system. They were created by the Bretton Woods Constitution. They are entirely outside of the UN system. They are financed by the largest donors, and therefore it's a weighted voting, and therefore they have been dominated for all their time by the big countries. And again, when we come to leadership, where is it written in which tablets of stone that the head of the World Bank should be an American? But for 60 years, the head of the World Bank has been an American. And the head of the International Monetary Fund has been a European, a Frenchman. where does all this come from? What kind of nonsense is this that we have locked ourselves into or are allowing ourselves to be locked into? Going on with the leadership thing further then, the competition to become the head of a specialized agency has become a political campaign that would hold the Tammany Hall or Mayor Daley to shame. Vast amounts of money change places. Dirty tricks are played. What has happened over the years? It means that we have gotten some extraordinary people as the heads of the agencies, the Brock Chisholms and the Gro Harlan Brundtlands in WHO, Julian Huxley in UNESCO, Reni Mayo, B.R. Sen in FAO. There have been some extraordinary human beings, and there have been some bums. There have been some real bums. If this kind of leadership is so important, tell me, why is it that governments apparently pay so little attention to the question of how it is we elect our leaders? Sir Brian Urquhart and Erskine Childers have written one, a memorandum on the UN. I did mine at their request on FAO. How we should go about selecting the head of these organizations is a very well-known thing. The smallest university, the smallest business spends more money recruiting and looking for the right person than does the international system, either the UN or the FAO or UNESCO or any of the other. What have governments been doing all this time? I don't know, playing a kind of a dodgem, as far as I call it. A problem arises and they figure out a way to either obscure it or to push it on the side burner and to blunt the edges of it. And let me give you a couple of examples of this. In the 70s, when I was in New York, the third world countries came up with something called the New International Economic Order. And there was a very long and very hot and very, very tendentious debate in the General Assembly over who was going to determine the philosophy and the meets the bounds of future policy direction. What happened? Well, in the end, nothing. The whole debate fizzled away, but there was one small moral agreement, namely that governments would make an effort to reach 0.7% of their gross national product as a policy matter. And that has been repeated in the Millennium Development Goals. It is accepted as a standard. The majority of governments in the world have not come anywhere near to living up to either the moral or, under the Millennium Development Goals, their somewhat more serious commitments to reaching 0.7% of their GNP as a contribution to development. And the Secretary General has reminded us that there will be no development without political security, but on the other hand, there will be no security without development. And that is the issue we are facing. In 1972, the issue of environment swam onto the stage of the United Nations. And there was a huge international conference in Stockholm, headed by that Canadian Maurice Strong. And some enormously important resolutions were passed about the world's concern for the world's environment. And what happened? Playing dodgem again, governments created something called the United Nations Environment Program, another little subsidiary organ, And did they give it a budget? No, they didn't give it a budget. It has to depend, like everything else, on voluntary funds. It is the most wonderful game. How many, in playing this Dodgems game, how many subsidiary organs of the United Nations have been created? Anybody have a guess? 14. 14 subsidiary organs have been created in this game of how to keep power from being centralized and being effective. And so each of them has been created in response to this game, this argument as to whether or not there should be a United Nations, and whether or not it should have the power to do the things that the Charter says. Because, incidentally, I would say, parenthetically, I think the Charter is an extraordinarily noble document. But so are the constitutions of the specialized agencies. Where can you find any more noble sentiment than in UNESCO's constitution, which says that if wars begin in the minds of men, it is in the minds of men that the frontiers of peace must be built. Or in the FAO constitution, in which governments commit themselves to ensure humankind's freedom from hunger. These sentiments are absolutely incredible. The problem has come that we have, in a sense, messed up the system. I told you that the UN system had to depend basically on voluntary contributions, the amounts that governments respond to when they are asked to give money to the World Food Program, to the United Nations Development Program, to UNICEF, and so on and so forth. The shortfalls exceed the successes. And it means that programs like the World Food Program have had to stop their donations because they have run out of money, and there is nowhere for them to get money. And every single effort that has been made in the past to figure out a way to produce income for the United Nations that is separate from that which governments control through the budget and through the voluntary contributions has been met with a deafening silence or defeat. There have been all kinds of imaginative programs. Paul Volcker, who did the study that you know on the Oil for Food program, headed one of them. Perhaps a tax or a tariff on arms sales, on international travel, on currency transactions. All kinds of ideas have come up as to how the United Nations system should be endowed with the ability to have its own income insured to an extent from the bad tempers of governments that can turn the faucet on or off at will. None has ever met with anything other than a resounding silence. There are a couple of serious missing pieces in the architecture of the UN system, and that is whether you talk about the United Nations itself or whether you talk about any of the specialized agencies. And that is the role of the transnational corporations. Where is the authority? Where is the policy? Where is the legislative guidance to control transnational corporations? And if you take them in terms of their effect, if you take the income of the 100 top agencies in the world, 77 of them are multinational corporations, and yet there is no forum within the United Nations or anywhere else to deal with the multinational corporations. And the second is missing piece, in my view, is people. As you know, the preamble starts with the bold political statement, "We, the peoples of the United Nations." And that is followed by the goals and the aims. And then that statement ends by transferring authority, quote, "to our respective governments." It has been said before and by others that nowhere else has there ever been such a complete, quick, and total transfer of power as there was. And so, in my view, it is also time to get people back into the affairs of the United Nations system. It is time to return to the idea advanced in 1945 by Ernst Bevin, the UK Foreign Secretary, who proposed, and I quote, "We need a study for the purpose of creating a world assembly elected directly from the peoples of the world as a whole, to whom governments who form the United Nations are responsible." This call has been repeated many times since. It is not a call for a super government. It is a call for a people's assembly where views can be expressed on major international problems and on the actions of the various parts of the UN system dealing with them, and to enhance the collective accountability of governments and to watch over the management and the financing of the system. The task of devising such a system was, in 1945, perhaps unthinkable, but with today's technology, it is not. Basically, we are running out of time. Our global economy is outgrowing the capacity of the Earth to sustain it. We are consuming our renewables resources faster than they can be regenerated. Our forests are shrinking. Our grasslands are deteriorating. Our water tables are falling. Fisheries are collapsing. Soils are eroding. We are discharging greenhouse gases faster than nature can absorb them. The world is incurring a vast water deficit. And the social and the economic gap between the rich and the poor is wider than ever before. Billions of people, almost a billion people, live on less than a dollar a day. According to the World Health Organization, 1.2 billion are undernourished, and FAO puts the figure of those who are chronically hungry, at 852 million. When we started the Freedom from Hunger campaign in FAO in 1960, our estimate was 800 million people. This is enormous progress, isn't it? Millions, billions are without access to clean water, without decent sanitary facilities. This is still, despite all of the things that we claim as the successes of the United Nations system, this is still a very grim world. A world with very little promise, unending grinding poverty, hunger, and privation for billions of our fellow citizens. And the system that we have, as I have described it with some of its warts, is simply not capable of dealing with it. And it is time that we took a long, serious look at what is needed for the 21st century. I can make no better recommendation to you than you read A Better Globalization by Kenneth Dervash, who is now the head of the United Nations Development Program and who is one of the unannounced candidates for Secretary General of the United Nations. His proposals for a new Security Council, a new weighted voting system, a new Economic Council, bringing the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank into the United Nations system, having the heads of the agencies appointed by the new Economic Council rather than being elected in this barbarian way that we now have. All of these things are spelled out in brilliant, I think, brilliant detail in Dervash's book. And a whole evening should be spent to doing an analysis of his proposals and of what kind of a system we really need. I would like to end by saying that I would certainly hope that I would not have to leave to my grandchildren Dr. Martin Luther King's words, which I would like to paraphrase. And he said that human progress is neither automatic nor inevitable. We are faced with the fact that tomorrow is today. Life leaves us standing bare, naked and dejected, with a host of opportunities. We may cry out desperately for time to pause in her passage, but time is deaf to every plea and rushes on. Over the bleached bones and the jumbled residues of numerous civilizations are written the pathetic words, "Too late." Thank you very much.
Now we hear several questions from the audience and responses by Charles Weitz.
They tried to have a world summit to make the organization stronger, and, you know, it's to organize 6 billion people. To me, it just seems a marvel that it works at all.
Of course, we could have spent this entire evening, we could spend in any time, congratulating ourselves on all the things that the system has achieved, because there have been some notable achievements. But if you just take the one statistic, 852 million people chronically hungry, and compare that with the fact that when we started the Freedom from Hunger campaign in 1960, there were 800 million. I don't think that's very much progress. I don't think that says very much for what we have been able to do. I do not think that with over between 1 and 2 billion people living on less than a dollar a day, we can congratulate ourselves on development. I just think we're always looking at the wrong thing, as far as I'm concerned. We're always looking at a specific object rather than, if I may say so, the system of global governance. And we are looking at individual projects that have succeeded, and we're looking at individual actions that have been richly rewarded, but we are not looking at the overall system, and we're not looking at the fact that the world is, in my view, in serious trouble, and we're headed for a series of disasters within the next 10 to 15 years if we don't do something.
The basic problem is that very few people want to give up power once they get it.
Oh, absolutely. I wouldn't disagree with you at all. And that is the issue we face. But what I'm trying to argue is that we collectively, the world, is facing a series of crises, and that we do not have in place a system of governance which is capable of dealing with it. The concepts of 1945 just don't fit 2006 anymore. And it is time that we had the courage to back off and say so. And if we can have the courage to back off and say so, we may have taken the first step toward beginning to figure out how to come up with a new system. Dervish has a system of weighted voting, which is practically veto-proof. And this we need. It is absurd, absolutely absurd, in this day and age, that any one nation, and I don't care whether it's this one or China, and certainly not second-rate powers like the United Kingdom and France, have the power to veto, to stop the action of the world. Mm-hmm. But it's just not acceptable. It's not acceptable politically, morally, ethically, in my view. And we have to find a way out of this.
We basically have a lawless world then, because we have corporations and we have trade and we have exchange of people happening all around the world. And we have no social contract that keeps us in any sort of toe, shall we say. Is there any way that you can think we could start moving in that direction? Because otherwise we are being run by the bandits.
You're absolutely correct. No, I do not have, as Lester Brown does, I don't have Plan B. I am very impressed with Dervash. I'm very impressed with his analysis, with the very cold logic that he brings to his reconstruction of a Security Council and of a new Economic Council to bring the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund and the specialized agencies under one general direction. But Dervash may be whistling as he passes the graveyard as well.
I just think we have to make it work, because we cannot survive as a planet without it. We have to find some way to make an international government work.
Absolutely.
And it may not work the way we want it to. We may need something else. But unless we can find something that overrides the economic power and the military powers of countries like ours, and that will somehow subdue this empire building, the planet will sooner or later blow itself up, and we'll go with it.
Hear, hear. I agree very much with what Midge has just said. I think we have to look on the system. It is the system that has failed, and that we need a new system of governance. We need to look at the whole. We need to stop looking at individual items. We need to stop debating about whether X or Y is working, or whether the budget is going to be approved or not be approved. We have to basically look, in my view, at the fact that we have a system that was designed in 1945 and has been meddled with almost continuously since then, that is not capable of dealing with the problems of today.
The next speaker is Joseph Elder, professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. The title of his talk is Two Friendly Proposals for UN Reform. Professor Elder.
There's a lot of talk about introducing improvements to the United Nations, and what I've tried to do is a very limited effort to address that by looking at two books, which I think are among the most thoughtful books that we have recently, asking the question, how can the UN become more effective? In terms of sort of the history of the UN, the fact that it was set up in 1945, it was set up at the end of World War II, the power structure, especially in the Security Council, reflected the powers that at that point probably felt entitled to be the major decision makers in the world. And these were the five countries on the Security Council: the United States, Britain, France, China, and the Soviet Union. It's now more than 50 years after that, and the question can't help but be asked, does that pattern of decision-making, with the Security Council having a veto with these five powers, still make sense? Or has the world changed so much that the fact that those five powers still hold the power that was given to them in 1945 should probably be looked at anew? So I'm going to begin with the kind of criticisms that have been raised by various countries about the structure of the UN, beginning with the notion that Kofi Annan has, among other things that were important, said, the United Nations is by no means a perfect institution, but it is a precious one. I urge you to seek agreement on ways of improving it. So the question here is, how do we improve the UN, given the fact that the world has changed so dramatically since the UN was established? The U.S. began with a great deal of support for the UN, and when one looks at the role the U.S. played in organizing it and getting the drafts put together, the role that Eleanor Roosevelt played in human rights, the United States was, in a sense, a champion of the UN. And one of the dreams was, and it's spelled out in the charter, was somehow to bring an end to the war, to not have the same thing happen another quarter of a century later as happened after World War I, which was a disastrous settlement with Germany, the Versailles Treaty, which in a sense laid the seeds almost predictably for World War II. And to the extent that we have not had World War III, we were marginally successful in setting up the UN. But the U.S. attachment to the UN began to fade fairly quickly. It wasn't long before we were in a Cold War. And the fact that the Soviet Union had the veto meant that many of the things that the United States would have liked to have done were blocked by the Soviet veto. For a long time, the only major country vetoing anything in the Security Council was the Soviet Union. Subsequently, the United States began to challenge the record of vetoing proposals in the Soviet Union. The beginning of the disillusionment of the United States with the United Nations began, I think, as more and more countries began to join, when it became clear that the U.S. did not have an easy majority, especially in the General Assembly. The fact that the provisions in Chapter 7 to halt wars was only carried out initially in Korea, and that was because the Soviet Union was vacant the day the vote was taken for enacting a collective military response to an invasion. And not until Kuwait, many decades later, was a second possible enactment of the effort to halt an invasion. In the meantime, new issues had come up that the Charter had never dealt with. Peacekeeping, peace implementing, safe havens, the whole problem of humanitarian intervention. These were things not envisioned in the original plan of the Charter. The Charter had nothing to say about civil wars, so long as they were confined within countries. The Charter maintained the integrity of individual nations. So with the combinations and confines of the Security Council and the UN Charter, there are a number of things that the UN couldn't do. But I think as the number of third world nations began to get into the United Nations, the United States began to feel that it was no longer its voice, especially when the issue of Israel came up, and there were condemnations by many of the new countries as to the stance that Israel was taking. The constant criticism that was coming, particularly from the Arab worlds, was something that also disillusioned the United States. When the third world, so-called, became up with the idea of the New World International Order, that began, I think, to create a certain amount of anxiety. The New World Order and the New World Information Order, as the third world nations had defined it, was to take a hard look at where wealth was going and where benefits were and where poverty was, and to take a serious look at trying to reorganize the world's economy. At that point, the United States began, I think, to back away fairly seriously. And this was not democratic, it wasn't Republican. When I became involved as a U.S. National Commissioner on UNESCO, we had something like 100 staff people in Washington. The Canadians had probably 175 people staffing UNESCO. And every single year, the staff was smaller and smaller until eventually, when the United States got out of UNESCO, there were probably only a dozen or so staff people. The United States was backing out of UNESCO as it was out of other organizations that it felt uncomfortable with, such as the International Labor Organization. This disillusionment led to disengagement. There were ways in which the United States began to sort of retaliate against the United Nations. One way was to try to change the way in which voting was carried out. The United States kept pointing out that when you looked at the amount of money that was being paid, the United States was paying more than most other countries, therefore perhaps the United States should have a greater say. And so the constant issue was to how you voted on committees began to look as though the United States was entitled to more power than its normal voting because it was giving so much. And then came, I think, ultimately the decision by Washington to, in a sense, try to bypass the United Nations. The whole series of statements about unilateralism, willingness to step out of a series of international treaties, left in the last perhaps 8 or 10 years a significant departure from the United States, almost as if the United States said, why don't we, in a sense, bypass the United Nations because it's not doing the kinds of things that it would do. So at the highest level, I think there is a great deal of disillusionment with the United Nations on the part of Washington and the White House and the Pentagon because it has not been an agent of our foreign policy. And if one looks, I think, especially at the debates just before the United States invaded Iraq, one sees that collision, that at a certain point the United States said, no matter what the United States, what the United Nations says, we are going to invade. And that was almost kind of a final statement to say, we don't care about the United Nations. We don't care about statements that nations aren't to invade other countries. If we feel it serves our interest, we will do it. So we are perhaps at a furthest point of disillusionment with the United Nations as we have ever been in American history. United Nations. Okay, then the developing nations. There was a hope, I think, initially, that as one looked at the charter of the United Nations, that it would lead to somehow the distribution of wealth so that the poorer countries could begin to change their balance of poverty. Whatever the plan may have been, the history has been in the opposite direction. The rich nations have gotten richer, the poor nations have gotten poorer. There are probably 25 or 30 nations that are trapped in a debt that there's no way they can get out of without some kind of serious reconfiguration. So for them, the United Nations has also been a disillusionment. Not that there was any promise that this would happen, but the hope was that if you had a world body looking at inequities, the fact that economic inequities produce enormous political inequities would have something done about it. Then there were the countries that began to feel that in terms of numbers, they were simply bypassed. India, perhaps the most dramatic. As India's population reached 1 billion people, the fact that it had no voice in the Security Council suggested that somehow it was being left out. China, the other country with more than 1 billion people, was in, but that was because of the accident of the Security Council in 1945. So from a series of positions, you can see country after country or section of the world after section of the world becoming disillusioned with the United Nations. So here we have the question, what could be done? What kind of ideas are there that would make it possible to address some of these concerns? There are a series of books that have come out. I picked two which seemed to me most interesting. One was by Joe Schwartzberg. Joe is a friend of mine. Joe has his PhD from the University of Wisconsin. He also is a South Asianist, and he is the author of probably the most important historical atlas of India. It's a book about yay thick, and 20 years ago it cost $125. It is the definitive series of maps on India. I know Joe well. Joe is a world federalist. And Joe, along with being a brilliant geographer, has also been very much concerned about the United Nations. So we'll look briefly at Joe Schwartzberg's plan, which has to do with weighting votes so that some combination of factors, population, gross domestic product, and so on, enters into the vote. And it's not simply the big nations, the five of the winners of World War II are in power and the rest of us are less powerful. And then the other book I want to look at most closely is Kemal Dervish's book. This Charles Weiss sort of told me to take a look at, and I picked it up. At first I began to curse him because it's a very tough book to get through. But by the time I got through Charles, I'm grateful you told me about him. I had not heard of Kemal Dervish, to some extent because he's not in the general global view. He's not an American, he's not a European, he's Turkish. And I think it's useful to look at the world through the eyes of somebody who's very bright, very thoughtful, very experienced, and stands at another point in the world. He's Muslim. He's from a Muslim country. It's a country that's sort of on the brink of enter the European Union. He at one point was finance minister in Turkey and bailed the country out of a very complicated financial situation. When I went to check his other books, they were almost entirely technical and economic. And so when I got to the book we're going to talk about, I thought, how can he be saying things that deal with something as complex as the politics of the United Nations? But he managed to include it all, and he has this component about economics, which I think makes it significantly different from most of the other books that are there. Okay, now the written assignment. Joe Schwartzberg. I've given a very sort of tight summary of where he is. The General Assembly, one representative from each nation, that's the way it's been from the beginning, would use weighted votes based on the nation's population, financial contribution to the UN, or perhaps gross national product, GNP, and membership in the UN. So it doesn't change the General Assembly in any particular way, but it weights the votes differently. So if you're from Malta, you have far less count when you vote than if you're from India, where you have 1 billion plus people. 18-member Security Council would include, so again, there's not much of a significant change in the number, one nations with weighted votes above a designated threshold, and the self-formed groups with weights above a designated threshold. So if a group of countries, let's say Southeast Asian countries, wanted to form a group and have that as an entity, that might be possible. They add their weight together. And three, one or more members elected by the General Assembly to round out the number of 18. So you have still the General Assembly, you have the Security Council, but now the number, the weight of vote depends upon the number of people, the gross national product, and its sort of contribution to the funding of the United Nations. Each member of the Security Council would have one vote. The veto would be eliminated after the phase-out period. The General Assembly would pass binding legislation, and the Security Council would implement it. So to that extent, it becomes something like Congress and the executive, with the General Assembly, with these voted votes now coming up with legislation, and the Security Council, in a sense, implementing it, with each member of the Security Council having one vote. And the veto would be phased out over a number of times. So Joe is working with numbers, working weighting, and with minimal change in the actual structure of the General Assembly and the Security Council. Kemal Darvis, with Sarah Ozer, brings in another dimension, the financial dimension. Here's where I think it becomes particularly interesting. The General Assembly, one representative from each nation, would remain unchanged. So still one country of one vote. Malta has one. India has one. The Security Council would include nations with weighted vote based on contributions to global public goods budget, population, GDP, and military capacity. Okay, here the notion is, again, you weight the countries in terms of, in a sense, how much influence they could have if there needed to be a peacekeeping operation. And to some extent, the size of the military would be the size of the military that could be put to the service of the General Assembly of the United Nations if some action were called on. And so the more military you're prepared to give, the increase in the weight that you have as a vote. The principle of single nation veto would be eliminated. However, the combination of weighted votes in the Security Council could produce a veto. And here you could work out, let's say, if there's going to be a military engagement, the 80% of the total weightage would have to combine to make that happen. If it were to be a major intervention in an ongoing war, they may have to be 66%. So one could work out some kind of formula as to, for the most serious act, it had to almost unanimity done with this weighting voting. And if it were simply a decision that were somewhat less complicated, the weight could be simply 50% plus one. So the weighting comes in interesting fashion here. The UN would establish a 14-member, here's where it's new. UN would establish a 14-member Economic and Social Council. You have to make it un-esque to fit into the United Nations, to make appointments to and monitor the boards of the governors of the International Monetary Fund and World Bank. And here, Darvis goes into a discussion as to what happened when the UN was being found. The plan initially was that there would be a branch of the UN that would be looking at the world economy, and this was to be ECOSOC. But what happened before that got into place was the Bretton Woods Agreement was made, and these were essentially made by large Western-oriented funding organizations, and from them came GATT, and then from them from the International Trade Organization. And so the big players, the big money players, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank have not been at all under United Nations control. They have been driven essentially by financial boards looking at the ways in which banks operate and boards operate. Darvis feels this is a serious shortage. And he goes on to say that so long as the United Nations is starved for funds and so long as a country like the United States can decide to withhold funds, there's not very much that can be done. As an economist, he was looking at those nations that are caught in a debt trap. There's no way now that they could ever pay the debts they're into. And his estimate was that to get those nations, and it's about two dozen, so they could operate with something of a balanced budget and possibly get back into the world economy, it would be $35 billion a year. And how are you going to get $35 billion a year? Here he comes with the notion of a global taxation policy. And the global taxation policy could be monitored by this new group, this board of the Economic and Social Council, the UNESC. What would they tax? The taxes could be on fuel, they could be on pollution, they could be on financial volatility if a country's economy is overheated, or even arms sales. These are things that can be counted and could be taxed, and then the money could, and being an economist, he says we could produce $35 billion this way every year, and that $35 billion would come in very handily in trying to take the bottom section of the economy, especially the African nations, and get them to where they can actually participate in the world economy and begin to trade and exchange. He mentions the UN's Millennium Development Goals. These were set up in 2000. And they were ambitious. The plan was that in a 10 or 15 years period, there would be virtual elimination of illiteracy. Almost everybody would have fresh drinking water, their medical health for most people. And looking at it 7 years later, there's been very little serious progress. The only significant advancement toward the Millennium Development Goals was in the reduction of poverty. And the country that signed it is China. That when you look at what China has managed to do, that is big enough so that it means we're on the international targets, even though most of the rest of the world has seen very little progress on that elimination of poverty. But otherwise, one looks at this clear water, one looks at the public health, one looks at literacy, and there's an appalling lack of growth. So that's part of the disillusionment of the developing countries. The Millennium Development Goals could lay things out, but there was no serious effort to get money. And no serious effort to put into existence the Millennium Goals other than to look periodically at how far the goals were from being attained. UNESCO's votes would be weighted by the contribution to global public goods, population and GDP, but not military budget. Okay, the notion here was that those who decide economics would have their weighting based upon, in a sense, their economies and their population. But the military part wouldn't come in because that's not involved in the economy. Now, see Table 9.1 below for proposed Security Council and UNESCO voting weightages. I don't expect you to memorize this, and this is not going to be on the final exam. But if you look at the way in which the scheme is, you begin with the general arrangements, the current arrangements of the UN Security Council. And there we have the permanent five with the veto power, United Kingdom, France, United States, China, and the Russian Federation. And if you follow them across, the permanent members, six seats, and then the transition UN Security Council, which is still the Security Council, and then the UNSEC, this is the economic one, the weights change a little bit based on that, the input that goes into the weightages. The only country that remains with enough sort of weightage so that it could almost veto what would be going on would be the United States. Although if the European Union could come in as a single member, they, with their weightage, could actually also have a veto. But otherwise, the veto virtually disappears in terms of the weighting that's here. So if you are going to stop something, you need to pool with other countries and their weightages so that you come up to the point you can essentially prevent something from passing in the Security Council. Then you get down to where efforts are made to make sure that both in the Security Council and in the NSEC, you have representatives from every part of the world. So look at the regional allocations, 10 seats. Asia has 2. Latin America, Caribbean, and Canada have 2. Africa has 3. Western Europe and others have 2. And Eastern Europe has 1. So these become sort of, each of these is up to some kind of debate. Derrius has a long discussion about the European Union. In some ways he feels this is perhaps the most miraculous thing that has emerged. If one thinks of how for centuries the French and the Germans fought each other and fought each other and fought each other. And at this point it seems almost unthinkable that the French and Germans would fight each other again. They're part of the European Union. There has not been the sort of constitution they were hoping for, failed in the vote, but there's an effort to have a common economy and a whole lot of common decision making. And if there were some way in which they as a group could become an entity, then they could become a countervailing power within the United Nations as a Security Council member and as the UNESCO number. Well, let me stop at that point. As I say, these are two, I think, thoughtful, interesting books. How does one amend the United Nations? There are provisions, and when one looks at them, one realizes that this is not going to be easy. One has to think that the countries that now have the power, the Security Council countries, are the ones that will be the most resistant because they have it good right now. There are two ways in which one can amend the Charter. Chapter 18 of the Charter provides two procedures for making amendments. Article 108, a proposed amendment takes effect when approved by a vote of two-thirds of the General Assembly, including all five permanent members. So that would mean all five of the countries with veto power would have to say we want to change, and that's not going to be easy. And then you have to have two-thirds of the General Assembly. Article 109, a general conference for review of the Charter may be established by a vote of two-thirds of the General Assembly and a vote of 9 of the 15 members of the Security Council. So this is now a general conference to look at this kind of thing. Any change of the Charter recommended by a two-thirds vote of the conference takes effect when ratified by two-thirds of the member states, including all of the permanent members. So once again, at this point in the revision, the fact that all of the permanent members would have to be in agreement means that this is looking at something that's very tough. Of all the countries that should be feel comfortable, the United States should, because with the weighting, with our gross national product, and the amount of money that we contribute to the UN, we have heavy weightage. The countries that would be resistant would be Britain, and Britain and France, because in a sense they are back to sort of just normal countries by the time you get all the weightage in there. China would be perhaps somewhat happy because now it's included in the Security Council. India would also be there, but neither of them has much of a weight. They have lots of population, but by the time you add the other factors, they don't come out very high. The Russian Federation would also, in effect, lose the veto because by the time you weight it, it's down to where it would have relatively little control. Is there any chance this might happen? Not in the immediate future. However, if one looks at the level of discontent right now and with the sort of hope that people like Kofi Annan are giving that let's give some serious thought to this, I think the kinds of questions that Dervish are raising, the notion that a secure source of money must be there and it must be ample, that depending upon members to make their contributions when a major member like the United States can sort of at its own will withhold funding, means that so long as that's the case, not much is going to happen. Both Schwarzberg and Dervish see this as something that has to be gradual, but anything that's gradual begins with an idea. So let me just stop at that point. All I can do at this point is say I think these are two very interesting books. One can look at the weightages. One can think of other kind of factors. But I find, especially in the Dervish book, a freshness which I haven't seen in any of the other books I've looked at, which simply have to do with weighting. I think this notion of the need to have a sound economy for the United Nations, and that there must be some sort of a body that's looking at monetary processes, things like the World Trade Organization, and things other than what provides revenue for those who have invested in these is a plus.
This program was sponsored by the Dane County Chapter of the United Nations Association, USA. Additional information is available at their website at www.una-usadanecounty.org. This recording was prepared by the Madison Institute. To listen to other thought-provoking programs, go to our website at www.themadisoninstitute.org. The views expressed here are those of the speakers and not those of the sponsor or of the Madison Institute.